Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. Doing a little Sunday night true crime, and it is Sunday night as I am recording this with Jack. So, you know, it was supposed to be on our late last week, and then I told Jen, hey, let's do this one, and I gave her, I don't know, like 3 hours notice. So we just postponed it till tonight. It was totally unfair of me to think that we could do it proper justice in that amount of time. So also fair warning, this might end up being in two parts, both tonight, but two parts because I have so many tabs open for Epstein that, you know, it could crash. I spent a lot of time at the In and Out this weekend, where Ghislaine Maxwell probably never was. So
sitting on half a bench, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, and Jen sends me stuff from about it that she finds. Everybody sends me things that they find. And I'll tell you what, this is, you know, it's, I guess in a way, the whole Epstein thing is true crime, but there's so many characters. If you go in and you read the depositions, if you go and read, you know, the charging documents, there's, you know, dozens upon dozens of people. And then if you look at the flight logs, there's more, and there's just all these nuggets that everybody can dig out or find. And
I know my inbox is full. Everyone is like, jump in, go help him. It's forensic. It's true crime. But I always tell them, Indy's got this. He has talked about it longer than anyone. He's been out ahead of it. So he will bring you the goods.
Yeah. You know, and it's good to have other, you know, mainstream reporters on. And there's people that are looking at a lot of things that bringing things together. There's the Whitney Webb, who looks at a bunch of things.
It has undoubtedly been the best coverage on a story ever.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, at some point, somebody's going to make a book. And I'm afraid that that book, to do it justice, is going to have to be 600 or 700 pages with a couple hundred pages of footnotes just to try and include everybody and try and bring it all together. Because you have the cases from, you know, 2000 and, you know, the original 2005, I think it was, or seven, whatever. And then the 2015 defamation suits. And then what was going on with 2018 when he was arrested. So you have all of that. And then
they need to do it right. Seriously. If anyone writes a book, cover the whole thing as if you are a poet laureate.
Yeah.
Cover it correctly. And you, like you said, it should be a phone book.
It should. There's, I don't think you could, you can't do things justice when there's something with all the depositions they did in, I think it was 2015. There's just 700 or 800 pages on that. And then the documents they released not too long ago, you know, another 600 pages. There's just thousands upon thousands of pages with a bunch of names. And it's just going to take a while to dig down and go through all those names. And then when you find somebody like a Jean-Luc, Brunel or whatever, you know, just he alone is worthy of a book of all the misdeeds and horrible things that he's done to people. And, you know, it just, you know, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. So I saw that Lifetime's going to do a Nexium, and I was like, how is Lifetime going to do a Nexium? So please, Lifetime, don't do a Jeffrey Epstein, because you'll just ruin the whole thing. So
they can't do that because they can barely scratch the surface.
Exactly. Speaking of scratching the surface, that's what we're going to do today. Tonight's subject is the Wonderland murders, which, if you're not familiar, you know, some people who live in LA who know about the Wonderland murders, if you've read about, they are much more brutal than the Sharon Tate murders. It's not even close. And, you know, I think that people just, and it involves people, some people that others will know, especially like John Holmes, who we'll talk about, who is probably to porn what Elvis Presley was to music. Just there was nobody, you know, more well known in the golden age of porn than John Holmes.
That is one thing I thought I would never be covering with you, is golden age porn, but here I am.
Yes, there you go. And I mean, and he is not just some kind of, you know, figure on the periphery of this thing. He is smack dab involved in these brutal murders. So, with that being said, Jen, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Wonderland murders?
Okay, so we are going down the rabbit hole of July 1st, 1981. It's the rabbit hole in the Hollywood Hills of Wonderland Avenue. And this isn't a fairy tale. This is tucked in the Laurel Canyon, the West LA District, and it's 8736 Wonderland Avenue. It was a swinging door for the mob, a Hollywood godfather, sex, organized drugs, and the four on the floor gang murders. That's where five people were targeted to be killed in the Wonderland gang drug house, and one survived. She's in bad condition, though. And it's what, like you said, LAPD describes as something that rivals the Tate LaBianca murders. And technically, this case is still unsolved.
Yeah, technically, it is still unsolved. And the other thing, that there is actual video of the crime scene that will make your skin crawl. It's on YouTube. I don't know why it's on YouTube. And it's narrated as the coroner is going through the crime scene. And if you want to see the most, if you've ever seen, say, like the Nicole Brown Simpson murder photos, multiply that by the four people that were killed, and then you kind of have an idea.
Yeah,
with a video.
It's like, oh yeah, the video is amazing. Like, and Tom Lang, he has one on there too, doesn't he? And he's from O.J. Simpson fame. You know, he covered that case.
If you're not from LA, but you've heard of Laurel Canyon, let me give you my two cents on the whole Laurel Canyon and canyon living. There are canyons, such as Benedict Canyon or Coldwater Canyon, that have these huge monster homes that are, for the most part, monstrous. And a lot of celebrities live there, and they're gorgeous homes. I do not put Laurel Canyon in the same type of, sphere that, or say Beverly Glen, which is another one that goes what we call here in LA over the hill down into the valley. When you live in one of these homes, especially Laurel Canyon, even nowadays, I mean, a lot of them have been remodeled, but some of them haven't, and they're dark, and they're generally, they kind of look like a row house, but they're pressed up against the canyon, which keeps one side almost completely dark all the time. You're down below. It's kind of like if you've ever lived in a basement, that's pretty much how it is when you're living in the canyon.
And we live in a basement, but I was just going to ask you, you know, those do look like row houses over there. And even though they've redone them, or if they've started to, I don't know, 2016-ish, why are they so expensive? Because to me, I don't see the selling point.
Because they're close to everything. If you want to be, you always want to.
Is it the art district that's a selling point?
No, I mean, Laurel Canyon, the only selling point is, you know, you're close to a dog park. Where this actually happened is really close to Harry Houdini's mansion. And then you're almost at the top of the hill, and the top of the hill's, say, Mulholland.
Yeah.
And then when you go over Mulholland, then you're heading down into the San Fernando Valley. But this particular house is still, I mean, people still live there, and it hasn't, there's somebody who's renting it right now. And they're paying, I think, $3,500 a month. And I don't know if I'd ever want to live in a house where just these brutal murders happened. It would take, if I ever heard any noise or anything like that, it would just freak the hell out of me.
It's okay. I got you. We can do like a paranormal investigation, just rent it out for a little while and then leave. That's the thing to do. I wouldn't buy it, but I might rent it.
I think that John Holmes is actually a good place to start, because he's actually on both sides of this. And people think of John Holmes as just a porn star, like I said, the king of the porn stars. I guess the only equivalent where maybe you could think of a male who's had the same kind of career in modern times would be somebody like a Ron Jeremy.
That's who I thought of. I was like, he must have been the Ron Jeremy of the times. But yeah, I mean, he was a high school dropout. He had little skills, but, you know, when push came to shove, he figured out what worked for him.
Yeah, you know, there's documented at least 559 porn films that he's made, but there was hundreds in a private collection that his wife, when he died, destroyed. He made gay and straight films. He prostituted himself out to other men. He himself was a pimp to women and way underage girls. So this is not, you know, this is not a nice person.
No, he was abusive. He could be a compulsive liar. At one point, he blended his character, you know, against his real persona, and just became, I don't know, a complete false identity.
it's always assumed that, I don't know, nobody ever measured him, but the whole Dirk Diggler character in,
Mr. X, your Mr. X had some good notes. You know what he said?
What did he say?
He said 13 inches and over 2,000 of those loop films.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a lot. There's a ton that he had on the loop. Some people say it was bigger than 13 inches. I don't know. Golden Age of Porn is not like, but, you know, Boogie Nights was all I needed to explore the Golden Age of Porn, really. You know, but I mean, people went to places, and you know, this was before you could watch it in the comfort of your own home. You know, which is kind of what Boogie Nights explores.
In the 70s, wasn't it illegal to not only be caught filming it, but to be participating? And it was like a secret squirrel thing.
It was, you know, and then you had Deep Throat and Devil of Miss Jones and things like that, and Debbie Does Dallas, and it kind of, you know, and if you haven't seen Boogie Nights, it really gives you this idea of this transition, because back in the 70s during the Golden Age of Porn, they really tried to have, quote unquote, a plot. The movies were fairly long, and they were filmed. I mean, actual film, 35mm film for the porns. And
yeah. I didn't watch this stuff, but I'm laughing at what you're saying because it's funny. Yeah, it was like not just the bow chicka bow wow. I mean, they like had real life plots. You know, they had started making storylines, and I guess that was appealing to people. So I read.
Yeah, and even later on, you know, there's a movie with Helen Mirren called Caligula, which was rated X, and that's almost. So every once in a while now you'd think of it as an NC-17, but Caligula is an X, and it has Helen Mirren in it and some other very, you know, well-known actors and actresses at the time who said, well, let's just do this. But if you see Boogie Nights, you'll see this transition from the 70s golden age to all of a sudden when camcorders came out and you could record to VHS, and how that just sparked an explosion in porn compared to having to have the bucks to make, you know, to shoot 35mm.
Oh, yeah. We covered a case like that not too long ago in old Hollywood about the guy who got the first camcorder, and he was using it in hotel rooms.
Yeah. So you have John Holmes, and he has this life where, you know, he went to the Army when he was 15, and his mom signed the permission slip. And, you know, he had a decent – he was only in for 3 years, but he got honorably discharged. There was – you know, nothing in his record, you know, to indicate that anything untoward happened. And then, you know, he got out and he bounced from job to job.
You know what I think it was? Health. Mm.
Yeah?
Yeah, because that lung thing, you know, he went on to have those collapsed lung, and then the lungs continued to collapse. And perhaps in the military when they did physical, maybe that was starting to kind of show up. Yeah. That might have been why he low-key got maybe discharged. But honorably.
Yeah, it was honorably. And when he got out, you know, it was just this, nothing was really, you know, making any, you know, money or anything. So in 1971, he said, well, you know, I'm going to start doing porn. And he built an entire, he had a franchise built around a character that he created, a private investigator named Johnny Wadd.
Yeah, I like the fact that he was a PI.
Yeah. And so then that was 71. And so then you had Deep Throat in 72. You had The Devil of Miss Jones in 73. It was, you know, kind of at that point it was becoming maybe it's legal, maybe it's not legal. It was in this really, really gray area. But part of the problem that he had was he wasn't making at that time. He wasn't making what he made later, which was about $3,000 per film, which is a staggering amount of money for a male performer. And nowadays, I don't know, there's certain guys that if they're known for something, you know, they might make $1,000 or even $1,500, but most are getting paid $300 or $400. So he was getting paid $3,000 in, you know, mid-70s. He was getting a lot. He was just, you know,
that's because he walked into the porn studio and they were like, no, we don't want you, because they didn't think he looked nice. Like, he wasn't good looking. And he said, hold up. And he dropped his pants because I read that story. And then they were like, okay, come back, sit down. Let's get you a contract. So literally, that's how it went.
I know. But at that time, when he first started, he wasn't making a ton. And so he got arrested for pimping and pandering, but he became an informant for the LAPD. So he managed to stay out of jail that time. And then he kind of, you know, did the porn thing. And it was in about the late 70s that he was making about $3,000 per movie. But he was spending it all on coke for the most part.
So was it a thing back then? I read that, you know, on these porn flicks, they had just a coke, a blow just laid out on the table. And everyone was known to take bumps. You know, it wasn't frowned upon. You just took a bump, whether you were cast or crew, it didn't matter. And then before you know it, like everyone on the set is hooked and their whole paycheck is going to it.
Yeah, exactly. And it was in about the mid 70s that he became, he met a 15-year-old named Dawn Schiller, and he groomed her and abused her. And when he didn't have any money, he would force her into prostitution and he would beat her a lot. And one of the times he beat her really badly, he did so in public. So this is not a nice guy.
No, he's horrible. He's trafficking her, selling her to multiple men. And ugh, I can't believe in the end she goes back to him.
I know. In about 1980, he's doing so much coke that he can't even stay erect for his porn performances, which, you know, causes, obviously, if you can't stay erect, then you're not going to get work. So then he turns more into petty theft and stealing and doing whatever he can to make some bucks. And it was in that time in 1980 that he got introduced to Eddie Nash, who is the crucial kind of go-between John Holmes and the people that are going to get killed. Well, I guess that John Holmes would be the go-between between Eddie Nash and the people who got killed. But Eddie Nash, not a nice guy.
No, he was definitely a shot caller. He moved to L.A. in the 50s, and he started out running a hot dog cart on Hollywood Boulevard, which we know is probably just making contacts. And before he knew it, he was in control of all the nightclubs, strip clubs. He was the Hollywood godfather and the go-to. He controlled, like, everything.
He did. Like you said, the godfather. This was the godfather for L.A., in the late 70s, early 80s, all the way up really until the 90s almost. And Eddie Nash, at the time when Holmes met him, was just, he owned a bunch of nightclubs and a drug dealer. And Holmes,
go ahead. Palestinian, though. Palestinian drug lord kind of changes things.
It does. And at the time, Holmes would sell drugs for people like Eddie Nash. He would, you know, use Eddie Nash's offense, anything that he could when he stole. But at the same time, John Holmes was friends with a group called the Wonderland Gang.
Yeah, he started out buying his drugs because he was, you know, hooked before he even started porn. He started buying from the Wonderland Gang. That's where he got the most of his blow from. And then he transitioned over to Eddie Nash, who I think might have had a plan for him all along, because here's this porn star. He's charming. He can get more people to come into the fold. That could be helpful to Nash.
Yeah. And this, when I talk about this Wonderland Gang, we're not talking about just some people who were using. The Wonderland Gang, they sold a ton of drugs, mostly heroin. But they had at any one time several $100,000 worth of drugs in their house. And a bunch of stolen property, and they had people going in and out all the time. This was a legit straight-up gang.
They were highly organized. The fact that they had SWAT gear, tactical gear, badges. You know, they had police badges from at least San Francisco and possibly LAPD. It seems like they used the San Fran badges in jurisdictions they probably shouldn't have. Maybe someone should question that, but that's organization.
Yeah, and, you know, they had a couple of leaders. I would almost say co-leaders, but maybe there's a guy named Ron Lanius, and he was probably the leader. But you know, there was Billy Deverell or whatever, and he was, I guess he was second in charge, but it was close. I mean, they pretty much ran it together. They one of the things that happened, though, was John Holmes was over at Eddie Nash's house, and he saw, you know, that Eddie Nash had so much money and everything in there. And he came up with an idea how to make more money than just doing, you know, penny ante kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. He was tired of being broke, and he was also in debt to the mob at this point, and that's one person you don't want to be in debt to. And he was like, how am I going to get out of this? Well, I guess I'll blackmail the Godfather and, you know, try to bail myself out. And in his mind, he was so far gone at that point, he thought, I'll steal all the drugs and it'll last me, you know, my lifetime. And I'll just run. You can't run from someone like Eddie Nash.
The property of Wonderland Gang was, well, first of all, the other thing I need to say about Wonderland Gang, besides heroin, they were the number one distributor of cocaine in the 1970s in Los Angeles. So think about all the stories you hear about coke in Los Angeles in the 70s and early 80s, but at least in the 70s, before they get killed in 1981. They are the number one distributor of coke. So this is how much money they had, how much in drugs they had. So the property was actually leased in the name of a woman named Joy Miller. And but Joy was a heroin user, and she actually has a really interesting story too. She kind of came. Oh, go ahead.
She does.
She kind of came into the gang after being married to a wealthy Beverly Hills guy, and just the heroin addiction just kind of, you know, became too much. She had two adult daughters. The Beverly Hills guy she was married to was an attorney, and she just, you know, got hooked on heroin. And the next thing you know, she's Billy DeVero's girlfriend. And, you know, she had been arrested 7 times, been treated for breast cancer. And 6 months before she was killed, she had had a double mastectomy. Actually, she wasn't killed, but she had a double mastectomy.
That's so sad. But I think what she did was she left that wealthy businessman that she was married to, and her love was drugs. So, you know, basically she rents this house and she sticks all these drug addicts and drug sellers in there with her. And that's kind of like an insurance policy of sorts. You know, it guarantees that she's going to have a consistent flow of drugs, you know, at all times.
So you have this cast of characters. You have Joy. You have Billy, who, you know, there's an author who once said, you know, he was a pretty decent individual who'd been lured into the drug world because of the easy money, but he didn't really like being a drug dealer. And he wanted to stop dealing. He wanted to stop using. I mean, he had an actual real trade. He was a crane operator, but he had been arrested 13 times.
Can you be a crane operator and be on drugs?
No, probably not, which is why he kind of stayed in the gang, you know, because he really, when you're arrested 13 times, it's tough to get, you know, a job, you know.
I would hope. Sounds like crane operator could go very bad if someone's under the influence.
So you have, then you have the leader of the gang who was Ron and Ron Lanius, and he had been in the Air Force, and he had also been, well, he had been dishonorably discharged because, get this, he had been convicted of smuggling heroin from Vietnam. Okay, I see that, but in the corpses of American soldiers.
Oh, he's that guy.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
He's that guy.
Okay.
And this guy, when he died, it was not something that the police really, I mean, they wanted him dead. They were happy to have him dead, but they had 27 open homicide cases just in Sacramento that they were believed were committed by Lanius. And now they were, you know, they were kind of out of luck. He had been arrested in May of 74 for a 73 murder of a drug informant. And, you know, then a key witness died in a shootout. So then the charges against him were dropped. It just, you know, he was just cold blooded. And one of the police officers, when they heard that he was murdered, said there won't be many pallbearers.
I guess not.
You know, this one of his cohorts said that You could put a gun to Ron's head and his pulse would never break 70.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, well, I guess if you're going to be the largest Coke distributor in L.A. and a huge heroin dealer, you just that's the kind of person you got to be.
I'm just flipping through his dockets, you know, through my mm-hmm. mind and looking at the victims. And some of them range in ages that are very young to older. And I don't know. It's sad. So I could see how they form an opinion of him.
So what you had on June 29th, 1981, you know, John Holmes says, hey, look, Eddie Nash has got a ton of money in his house. And Eddie liked to refer to himself as the Nash. But so Holmes says, look, you can go over there. There's not a whole lot of people over there. I think there's just one bodyguard and there's a ton of cash. There's a ton of drugs. There's a ton of property. And Eddie Nash trusted John Holmes. Eddie Nash called John Holmes his brother. So, you know, this is, you know, something that Holmes feels like, okay, I can pull this off. Now, Holmes, on the day of the robbery, went over to Nash's house, you know, to party, to buy some drugs, but on his way out, left the patio door to the kitchen opened. And he actually went to Nash's house three times that day, because the first time he forgot to unlatch the patio door. The second time he did so, but returned to the Wonderland hideout to find that some of the gang members were just wasted on heroin. And then so Holmes was worried that the patio door might become locked again, so he went over there a third time, purchased some crack, and made sure that the door was unlocked again, and then notified everybody that the house was ready to be broken into. I mean, this is Keystone Cops. This is just, it's hard to believe that this thing even kind of succeeded.
You know, when you have someone that really trusts you like that, the guy was probably not paying any attention to Holmes, and Holmes is not the brightest bulb, of course, but he was determined to get that patio door open. That shows you how bad he wanted to rob this guy. Scary.
Yeah, it is. So you had four people that invaded. You had Lanius, you had Devrel, you had this guy named Lind, and you had another guy named McCourt. Now, Lind was a biker. He was a member of the Aryan Brotherhood. They, you know, he got to know Lanius when they served time together in jail. And then McCourt was supposed to actually be involved in the home invasion, Lynn took away McCourt's gun because he didn't think that McCourt would be up to it. So McCourt ends up just doing the driving.
Yeah, McCourt's like, I'm not going in there without being packing, so I'm just going to be the getaway driver.
And McCourt actually is not killed in the killings, and he, you know, I think he's still alive. He started a successful, you know, mobile phone franchise, so. You know, he had a career and a life after all of this. But so you have these four guys, and they go in and they have like liquid Band-Aids so they don't leave any fingerprints behind. I don't think Eddie Nash was going to call the cops anyway to have the fingerprints checked.
I doubt it. He didn't want anyone in that house.
But so they just the object of this, honestly, was just to go rob the place. They didn't want to hurt anybody. Which, you know, despite, especially, you know, Lanius' reputation seems kind of surprising, but I guess maybe they drew the line at, you know, shooting anybody because maybe they're afraid of what would happen. And sure enough, that's what did happen. But
actually, that was their critical and then later on fatal error was if you're going to go in on the Godfather, you might not want to leave him alive because
yeah,
you don't think that, yeah, he's going to come for you.
So they actually did go in through the sliding glass door. And Nash was there and a bodyguard named Gregory Dials. And they went in pretending to be police officers. Like you said, you know, they had badges and everything. I have a hard time thinking that Eddie Nash didn't know who any of the Wonderland gang members were. But from later events, it looks like he really didn't.
He maybe did not because he was on such a high tier and he considered them the lower rung. So maybe he didn't pay attention to them, or were their faces covered at any point?
I don't know, but maybe he wouldn't have known their faces anyway. Maybe he knew their names, but not their faces.
Yeah, because remember, Holmes, he wasn't there, right? He just sent in his associates, and, you know, Nash probably didn't know them.
Yeah, and Holmes wasn't there. So then, as they were handcuffing Nash and Dials, Lind accidentally shot Dials in the back after Long has bumped into him.
That's a guy that needs a gun right there.
Yeah, you know, it injured the bodyguard. And then Nash asked to pray for his children, but he had to open the safe. This is where I've seen more reports saying that this number is accurate, so I'll go with it, but they got a little over $1 million in cash.
That's what I read. Yeah, $1 million.
There was a time where I think Nash at one point said they only got 10,000, but there's too many people that have said over $1 million. So I'm going to say $1 million. I think Nash said 10,000, so nobody would have the idea to come in again thinking that there was going to be $1 million in there.
Exactly.
But the million was worth about $3 million in today's dollars. And there was also a ton of cocaine and heroin and anti-guns and jewelry. But I tell you what, you know, you go in there and you think you're going to celebrate and be able to spend it all, and the Nash had other ideas.
Oh, yeah. By the time he unbinds himself and unbinds the bodyguard, he is already steaming with malice, and those people were dead probably before he even picked up the phone and called in the hit. They just didn't know it yet.
No. So after the robbery, then you have Holmes come back. Just do. Oh, what? You got robbed? What? So he went there to try and make himself appear innocent. Sometimes people will say that Holmes was kidnapped because they recognized him walking around wearing some of Nash's jewelry. Now, you know, Holmes is an idiot, but to see somebody, you know, that looks like Nash's jewelry, you know, walking around, I think that the former is probably right, where Holmes says that he went back over there, and then Nash became kind of suspicious.
He might have went back over there to see what was left, because after the robbery was finished and the home invasion, his associates were supposed to come back and they had a meeting spot and they were going to just split the loot. And then somehow Holmes gets the losing end of the deal. He gets shortchanged on it. And at the time, he doesn't really say anything, but that plays in later. You know, the detectives try to use that against him. So maybe he went back to Nash's home to see, you know, what did my associates really get? You know, maybe he wanted to hear Nash talk a little bit about the safe. You know, was he completely wiped out or did he have some stuff left behind? I'll always be curious about that.
So then you had, there's one story. There's a guy named Scott Thorson, who, if you have read anything about Liberace, he was Liberace's longtime lover. He wrote a book, My Life with Liberace. Now, he says that he was buying drugs at Nash's house and that Nash had ordered Dials, the guy who was shot in the back. So presumably it was just a graze, which I think it was. I think I remember seeing that.
Yes.
To bring Holmes to his house, which Dials did. And then this is where the story is, where Dials found Holmes walking around Hollywood wearing one of Nash's rings.
Correct. Yeah, he was leaving a phone booth where he had called Dawn. I guess he was supposed to split some of the loot with her, too. So he was looking to meet with her. And allegedly he had on a ring that came out of Nash's safe and Dials saw it. So he told, you know, Nash, yeah, that's your guy.
So then you had, and Thorson is still there, even when Holmes gets brought back. So he's there for quite a while, I guess. And Thorson says that he witnessed Nash order Dials to beat Holmes and threatened to kill Holmes and his family until Holmes identified the people behind the robbery.
Yeah, they allegedly tied Holmes to a chair and beat him with a steel pipe and at times just smacked him just, you know, with their bare hands and made him give up every single person that was involved in the home invasion, which he did.
There was something about Holmes's wife at the time.
I want to say that, aside from her sitting at home going, what the?
Yeah. You know, so after he got beaten, she said that on the morning of July 1st, 1981. Okay, the morning of it. So she says that he came into their Glendale bedroom bleeding and told his wife that he'd been in an accident. And that he was moaning about blood and pain. I'm wondering if that's, you know, when he got beaten up by Nash. Because I think by all accounts, everybody knows that Holmes was beat up to give up the names. How he got there, whether he came voluntarily or, as Thorson said, you know, he was dragged in off the streets by Dials, that is, you know, up to debate. But I think everybody agrees that he had the snot beat out of him to give up the names.
Yeah, he definitely got the snot beat out of him, whether he joined the other team in the end or not. But I'm confused by that story only because he tells two, and one is linked to a confession that also, you know, his wife relays back. He goes from saying that he was an active participant in the murders to saying that he was kept at another house at gunpoint while the murders were going on. So it's tough to tell, you know, when Holmes is telling the truth. And also, he did run from LAPD. He was on the lam for 5 months. They had to go hunt him down. Then he still wouldn't cooperate.
No, he never cooperated his whole life. And even when he was dying of AIDS, when they finally decided, oh, we should go talk to him before he dies, they waited too long, and, you know, he wasn't really coherent at all. But so then you have, and I tend to think that he was in a car outside, or actually they brought him in after they had kind of secured the place. He was definitely in the house at some point.
Yes, because forensics, the CSI gang, they go on to find his fingerprints over one of the victims. And it was reported.
Yeah, it wasn't even just the fingerprints. It was that whole damn palm. Like,
right.
Somebody grabbed his hand and said, here, we're putting your entire handprint in the bloody headboard. Mm-hmm. And so people will come find you. This is, you know, you set it up. This, all the money's gone or whatever. This is your punishment.
Yeah, two fingerprints on the rail. And then, like you said, that handprint, that whole palm. So, I mean, that definitely puts him at the murder scene. Whether they drug him in and just put his hand in blood like it's finger paint and slapped it on the wall, you know how mobsters can be, and said, look, that puts you there. Now you're one of us. Either that, or maybe he did participate. I don't know. Maybe he was leaning on the wall to see if the person was alive. It's hard to figure out, but he was definitely there.
I mean, if you look at pictures from this crime scene, there is hardly anything in the house that doesn't have blood splatters on it. So
someone took a bucket of blood.
Yeah. An entire house. I mean, record albums, the walls, the floors, the ceiling. I mean, everything has blood splatters on it throughout the entire house.
They said that Nash and his group could be very angry. They had tempers like you would not believe. And when you talk about someone getting bludgeoned to death by a hammer and then also steel pipes, they were hit repeatedly, just over and over again, overkills.
So at 4 p.m. on July 1st, police get a phone call from some furniture movers. And they had been working at the house next door. And they heard, I mean, they called them desperate, pained moans, but I can't imagine they must have been, I mean, to get furniture movers to want to go over next door to do that, these moans must have been something else.
Oh, they had to be horrible. I mean, the neighbors talk about they were primal screams, but that home was known for such transient traffic and people that were withdrawing. You know, they would line them up on the street, kind of like on the side street, and then you had to wait your turn. You would go put your money in the basket, and they would lower the basket up, and then your drugs would come back down in the basket, and that's how their operation worked. So the people withdrawing, sometimes they had a long wait, and you'd hear people howling. Those neighbors thought, it's just those people howling again. Did they call the police? No.
No, because, you know, at 3, I mean, later found out, okay, so 3 o'clock in the morning, they were screaming, but they said they're screaming every night.
Yes.
So, you know, it's like, you know.
They're like, nothing new.
Nothing new. But the investigators, they walk in, and right away, they see the body of Barbara Richardson, who was David Lynn's girlfriend. And she was lying on the ground near the couch that she had been sleeping on. She was covered in blood.
She was the first victim.
Yeah. I mean, she's in between, if you go look at the videos or pictures, she's in between a coffee table, kind of like in a couch, and she's laying down on the ground. She's next to some record albums, and there's a plant, and there's just blood everywhere. This was not a shooting. This was, we are going to take whatever we have, say crowbars or baseball bats, and we're going to beat the living hell, beat these people to death.
When you talk about stabbing someone with, you know, the puncture end of the hammer and then also using the hard side of the hammer, it's very personal. And then a pipe is just finishing you off completely.
So then Joy Miller, and I got it wrong, it's Lawness's wife that lived, not Joy. But Joy was found in her bed, and then Deverell's body was slumped at the foot of the bed, leaning against the TV stand. There was a bloody hammer in Miller's sheets. There was several metal pipes littering the floor. But this guy, Deverell, I mean, there is a picture that you would think... He's almost sitting up. He's not wearing a shirt. He's wearing long pants. I think that they're white. It's hard to tell. There's so much blood, and you're talking about a still from a video. He looks like maybe he's kind of slumped where his half is not even half. His head in an arm or underneath a TV stand where, you know, the TV's on top and it's kind of like a tray situation. There's a tray down at the bottom. And he's up against the back, and he is literally covered in blood. There is not one spot on his body, on his pants, really, that doesn't have blood all over it. The sheets or the blankets next to the bed are covered in blood. The floor is covered in blood. It's just,
Yeah. All of these people that used to be brunette and blonde, they are all nice redheads now. And like you said, everything in the whole home is just a grisly murder scene, completely just buckets of blood. I mean, even in the worst horror movie, I don't think I've ever seen crime scene photos like that.
No, not at all. And then you had Susan, that's Lonnie's wife. Now, she's the one who lived. She's the one who was moaning. She's the one that, you know, got the attention of the furniture movers. And she was covered in blood on the floor next to the bed that had her dead husband's body. Now, her skull was bashed in, but she was still alive. And she actually made a full recovery.
Kind of. I mean, she is a sole survivor, but look at what she went through. She had permanent amnesia. Well, at least they thought it was permanent for the longest time. Some of her memory came back. And then she had to have part of her skull surgically removed.
I know. Crazy.
And then some of her fingers were missing.
Yeah. And she had been lying on the floor alive with her skull broken for about 12 hours. And then the police search with the video, and the video shows this bloody handprint on the headboard above Ron Lanius.
Yeah, right above his head. Here's the thing I want to ask you. What about the people that they claim came in and stepped over the dead corpses to clean out the home? You know, they came in, they said it was drug addicts at first, coming in to get any narcotics or any money that wasn't secured. You know, everyone's dead in the house, so they're going to raid it. Do we think that those were just average drug addicts, or in looking at Nash's deposition in the end, do we think it was his associates that came in and took stuff?
Yeah, I think it was his associates.
I do too.
I think any average drug user who went up there, if they walked in that door, they would turn around and just walk right back out.
Yeah.
I something like that has got to be the most horrific sight, and, you know, I just... Do they want to be associated with that? And no, I think that they would.
Oh no,
they would fail in that.
Not if they have pipes and drugs and stuff on them. Usually they'll run. They'll be like, nope, I don't want to be a part of this.
So Holmes is actually arrested, and he was charged with four counts of murder. But you know, that story, like you had mentioned earlier, where, you know, he was retaliating because of the division of the goods. It just wasn't really very convincing at all. And it just kind of seemed like he'd been caught in the middle between them. You know, he was bribed to unlatch the Nash door, and then Nash, you know, thought he was an accomplice, so beat the hell out of him. And
I mean, yeah, you had two LAPD detectives that were veterans. You had Tom Lang, who had OJ experience. You had Frank Tomlinson was somewhere in the mix, and he had dealt with the Hillside Strangler. And then these guys know what to do to play good cop, bad cop. They paint Holmes into a corner, you know, to basically get him to roll on Nash. They painted Holmes out to be a conspirator against his own gang. And,
yeah, and
he sung like a canary.
Yeah. And Holmes was acquitted, but he refused to give any evidence during the actual trial because he probably didn't want Nash to kill him.
Uh-huh.
So he ended up serving about 4 months in jail for contempt of court. But then they went after Nash. And they arrested him and charged him with the murder. And he was saved by a hung jury. Just one juror stood between him and a guilty verdict. And do you want to let everybody know why the one juror didn't vote for him to be guilty?
Cha-ching. He had that money. He was paying off jurors.
That's right. He paid off one juror a ton of money.
$50,000.
Yes. And the juror just said, no, no, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. And so it was a hung jury. And apparently the DA said, okay, well, we're not going to bother again, which I find remarkable. And, you know, so he walked free until about the year 2000. So yeah. 19 years after the murder.
I think that's why. I think they continue to watch him and let him dig himself a nice grave, and then they went in on him, because look at what happens in the end.
Yeah, so he was charged with drug trafficking and money laundering, and as a part of the plea deal, he admitted to having bribed the jury back in the original trial. And then he did say that he did, you know, command his men to go get the stolen items back in the Wonderland house on the night of the slaying, but he never, ever admitted to having ordered the murders.
Which I thought was crazy. You're right. He distanced himself from anything to do with the homicides.
Yeah. Dials died in 1997. There was something I wanted to say about Nash after that happened. Okay. He was sentenced to 37 months, including, so he never admitted, but it was including a conspiracy to murder four people. So, I mean, he never really admitted to it. I mean, I think everybody knows that Nash was the one who did it. I mean, I guess technically it is unsolved.
That's why I tell people, you know, they're always asking, you know, what do you and NT solve? And the thing is that we solve a lot. You can look at something and tell who did it. But the problem is evidentiary support and all these plea deals. You know, if they plea out, what can you do? Yeah, the guy probably did it.
I mean, and some of the, yeah.
How he worded it was, you know, well, maybe my people went in and then they got a little too obnoxious and maybe that led to deaths, but I didn't outright call a hit.
Yeah, you know, and it's just sometimes also it's just legal mumbo jumbo. So, you know, it's still unsolved because nobody pleaded guilty to the actual murders. His was more of a conspiracy thing. It's the same thing with Epstein. Technically, you know, the charges had to be dropped when he committed suicide. So he's technically, quote unquote, innocent.
Correct.
Because, you know, you have to prove that somebody's guilty and you can't, you know, if he's dead. It's the same with Aaron Hernandez. You know, he was in jail and he had been convicted, but it was on appeal. So technically, when he committed suicide, he became innocent.
Yes. And that's the American justice system. And if it was, you know, any of us or any of the listeners, you know, I would want it to be the same way. It has to be like that because you have the right to be tried and found guilty.
Now, going back to Holmes, just as we'll wrap it up with him, you know, he got out of jail, November 82. So then, you know, this is a new generation of porn stars. This is the camcorder generation. But, you know, he's still, you know, on drugs, but he's still getting a lot of work because, you know, he's got the name, but he's not getting $3,000 anymore because now it's videotapes. So they're just churning out movies, churning out movies, churning out movies. And that saturated the porn market and people go, oh, you know, but that's nothing compared to the saturation of the internet with the internet. But I mean, at that time it was a ton. So a lot of the things that he did back then were just kind of cameos. In February 86, he was diagnosed as HIV positive. And he, you know, his wife said that he had never used hypodermic needles and stuff like that. I'm guessing that, and all of his friends said he would never use IV. So I'm guessing it happened during, one of his, gay porn shoots. I'm just guessing.
Either the gay porn or him being at the Starwood and prostituting himself out in the bathrooms to men.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, something like that. He was offered a deal in 86 by a company who didn't know that he was HIV positive, and he traveled to Italy to make what was his last two porns. And one of them actually starred Ilona Ciccolina Staller, who later became a member of Italian parliament.
Oh, don't tell me that he, oh.
Yeah, and, but I think that, I think she's still alive now. I've not checked. But Amber Lynn was in this movie.
Was it Unprotected Sex?
Yes, yes.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then he also did, the final film he did was Devil and Mr. Holmes, and it was revealed later that he had chosen not to reveal his HIV status to his co-stars before engaging in Unprotected Sex for the filming.
Oh, shame on the studios, yeah. Italian or not, for not
Well, no, they didn't know. They didn't know. Well, I mean, they didn't test him. So
that's the problem. And then shame on him for being just, oh, a jerk.
And, you know, he told the public that he was suffering from colon cancer. Then he got married in 1987, but he did tell her that he
married
had
him?
AIDS. Yeah.
Wow.
And then
someone for everyone.
Yep. And then during the last 5 months of his life, he was basically in the hospital, and then he died in 1988 at the age of 43. He died, 7 years after these murders, not even quite 7 years. So, I mean, John Holmes, you know, was the king, and then, you know, drugs and all this kind of stuff just, you know, it ruined him and it killed a whole bunch of other people. And, not a nice guy. You know, pretty much from the time of his porn career down to the end. So, you know, I think the Wonderland Murders, if you want to, you know, take a look, I would definitely, it's really fascinating. There's actually not been, there was a movie called Wonderland, which was absolute crap.
Is that 2003 one?
Yeah, it has Val Kilmer as John Holmes, and it is, I mean, it's got a lot of good people, and it's got Val Kilmer, Kate Bosworth, Dylan McDermott, Carrie Fisher even, Josh Lucas, Christina Applegate, Lisa Kudrow, Janine Garofalo, Eric Bogosian, but it's awful. And
I like the cast, but yeah, the script or something, I don't know, just how they put it together. Yeah, it was bad.
And then Boogie Nights is kind of, like I said, based on John Holmes a little bit, and there is a little part that's inspired by the Wonderland Murders, but there's not a whole lot. And I guess, you know, 2003, when they made that movie, it's still not out of the consciousness enough, but, you know, they could definitely do it better justice, because it's a compelling case. It's a compelling story. There's a lot of characters. There's a lot of things to say. And, you know, they got good actors and actresses. It's just the movie was not good.
So. Oh, yeah, definitely. If you do a deep dive on this case, it's worth looking into, because if you do your own research, like you said, movies, that is not going to work for you. Read. It's really good stuff. And also read about LMFAO spending the night at that house. That's a funny story.
Yeah. Oh, another case that is in the books. So, Jen, I want to thank you and for being flexible with your schedule. And you can find Jen on patreon.com/deadanddocumented. You can find her on Twitter at Mascara and Mace. So I really appreciate it. I appreciate you. And tune in again next week for some other Hollywood murder unsolved crime.
Yes. Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye.